Sensible Cities with Robots, the podcast for news and views on robotics. Hi and welcome to the 97th episode of Robots. My name is Jana, and today we will be exploring Sensible Cities with Carlo Ratti, director of the MIT Sensible City Laboratory. But first, as always, let's get the news with Christine.
Thank you. US company AnyBots, which you may remember from our previous reports on telepresence robots, have just launched a robot receptionist. The Any Lobby Robotic Staffing Service allows you to hire one of their QB telepresence robots along with a human operator to act as a receptionist or as an assistant. According to press reports, a full-time 40-hour robot receptionist will cost you $2,400 a month. Although the robot does not have arms, it can move, talk, scan, and print documents. This makes the job more complex than that of, say, a security camera operator who can just raise an alarm based on what's seen on the screen. But it still allows you to quite literally work three jobs at a time, all from the comfort of your home. In other news, US company Gamma 2 has successfully tested an autonomous security robot. In the test, Vigilus patrolled a parking garage for a full 8-hour shift, navigating its course through the garage and yielding to moving cars and avoiding obstacles. As one of the robot's inventors points out, people get bored and have stressors that distract them, or physically don't feel up to the challenge of patrolling a cold parking garage for a full shift. This, along with the low pay, required background and drugs test, unattractive working hours, and simple dullness of the task is the reason why an average of 1,500 patrol and report security officer jobs remain unfulfilled even in the current economic climate. The robot will be available by the third quarter of this year to report on intruders or changed object locations, as well as the detection of smoke, water, and hazardous gases in patrol parking garages, as well as warehouses, event centers, museums, and art galleries at night when these places are largely unoccupied. For more information on the new robot receptionist or Vigilus, have a look at www.robotspodcast.com.
Carlo Ratti is an engineer and architect who also directs the Sensible City Lab at MIT. Here, Ratti and his colleagues study city environments using sensors and handheld electronics. They also use these technologies and others to create completely novel environments. He spoke to our reporter Amanda about two of his exciting projects: the Flyfire, which aims to create immersive, interactive environments using self-organizing micro-helicopters, and the Sea Swarm, a system for ocean skimming and oil removal.
Okay, hi Carlo, and welcome to Robots.
Good morning.
So in this interview, we've chosen to touch on two of your projects in particular because they have a strong link to robotics. So the first one is Flyfire, a project which is dubbed a swarm of pixels in space. So first of all, maybe can you kind of explain how this really works?
Yes, but first let me tell you something about what we do at our group at the Sensible City Lab in Boston. And, you know, we're not really about robots, but we are looking at how technology is radically changing the interface between us and the environment. And of course, if you look at that, then networks are very important and robots are very important and many other components really that today are radically redesigning, redefining the interface between us and what is out there. So I want just to say this in the sense that we are not really specializing on robots. Actually, sometimes we collaborate with other groups at MIT, either in CSAIL or at the Media Lab, in order to look at robots together. But our goal is the Sensible City Lab is really to look at how technology is changing the interface with the environment. Having said that, you know, about FlyFar, well, you know, you basically said it. It's the idea is to have small flying pixels, and then every pixel is a small helicopter, and then if you control all the pixels together, then you can get almost like a flying screen, something where, you know, you can control each of the pixels individually, you can display images, you can use it as a screen itself, and so the effects you can have become incredibly nice, because it's like as if the pixels on your computer screen were flying into the air and you could still control them one by one individually.
Sounds great. Was the initiative for this project coming out from your lab? Because I know that you worked in collaboration with the ARES lab, Aerospace Robotics and Embedded Systems Laboratory. Or do you kind of sit together and out of discussions, this kind of just pops up the idea? Who actually came up with the driving force here?
It really changes. With the projects in our lab. You know, sometimes it's something that comes out in collaboration. Sometimes it happens inside the lab. Sometimes discussing with a partner and so on. So in our case, it can change. In this case, actually, it is something that we developed in the lab. Actually, I developed it initially thinking about a project for London and for the Olympics, and then based on that. Together with Emilio, who's the head of ARES Lab, I went to talk to him and he thought it was a cool idea, so we started working on it together.
Okay. So the small size and lightweight of the robots actually really heavy constrains the autonomy of the robots. So, I mean, when you go about developing this idea, what kind of general design choices did you have to kind of put down on paper in order for this whole platform to become viable?
Well, you know, the project is still under development. We got a few flying, and we're still scaling up. But you know, when you think about something like this, about micro robots flying, one key concern, as you said, is weight. So weight is very, very important. Another key concern is controllability. You want a system that responds very, very fast, so you can actually keep them in the right position. And you know, you've got all type of interference. You've got interference with the air. The air is moving, so you want really in real time to be able to adjust them. But also you get interference in terms of the signals you need to send in order to control them. So that's another issue you need to look at. And then, of course, the third issue is about location. Most of the people who've been doing flying robots flying small helicopters in space, indoor space, they usually use a tracking system with cameras. And that is fine if you've got two of them, if you've got five of them, you can even go to a 50 of them. But if you really want to scale it up, you need to find a different way of locationing. And that's what we're working on.
Okay. So you mentioned controllability. Do you intend to run the whole control on board the flying robots, or do you think you might have to kind of split half of it off board onto some sort of centralized computing unit, or do you think you're going to be doing everything actually off board? Do you have any idea of how you're going to handle the computational load?
It's a great question. You know, when you do a design a system like this, really you have two extremes, the ones that you mentioned. One extreme is that you keep all of the intelligence basically fixed. You keep it on your computer, and then you just control the helicopters, but then all the decisions are made on the ground, say. And then the other option is really to do a swarm that controls itself and all intelligence is there. And actually, these are the two extremes. Actually, what you want to do is probably something in the middle. What we're working on at the moment is actually something in the middle, because, yes, you want to give the helicopters as much intelligence as possible, but still also you want to be the one who controls them as a screen, so you still want that, call it the ground controller, has quite a lot of power, and then it's much easier to run things on a computer, on a centralized computer. So it's a kind of something in between the two extremes.
Right. I was exactly thinking, because of them being flying vehicles, the control has to happen at a very high frequency, which doesn't actually make it easier for the task.
That's correct, yes.
So, So you mentioned that this thing is really built around the idea of interacting with some sort of environment, right? So I was wondering, what is your approach going to be towards this kind of interaction concept? Do you think you'll be having the sensors kind of onboard the robots, or will you be relying on some sort of external infrastructure to understand what's going on in the environment in order for your whole system to be able to kind of react and interact with what's going on in the place that it's happening actually? Do you have any ideas of how you're going to construct this?
Well, you know, this is a very good point. And actually, ultimately, we are developing the system at the moment mostly as a display system. But ultimately, yes, you know, you could think about this as a way for sensing the environment. People have been using small cameras on helicopters for a while as a way to collect visual information. So, yes, you're right. Ultimately, you want to give quite a lot of sensing capabilities to the individual pixels, to the individual helicopters. We're not doing that at the moment, not yet, but that's certainly the direction we're looking at.
Mm-hmm. I saw that you have already developed several concepts of display, actually, for your pixels. So I saw you talk about a freeform display, a raster image display, and also a vector image display, which would then actually be able to kind of incorporate 3D objects in space. And I was wondering, are you kind of going to intend to have one swarm of pixels kind of implementing one type of display at a time? Or will you actually also think of morphing actually from one type of display to another type of display? And if so...
Yeah, I'm not sure if I got your question right, but actually the beauty of the flying pixels mm-hmm. is that really you can seamlessly merge between one thing and the other thing. So,
exactly.
So it's only mm-hmm. a matter of control, but you can go from the regular grid to a dynamically changing surface to any type of 3D configuration, and you can seamlessly and easily go from one to the other.
Right. So the idea is really that you're morphing from one into the other, and there's no actual separation between one state from another. It's just going to be total seamless.
Yes, correct.
Okay. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, you did touch on the swarm organization concepts before. Do you actually intentionally lean on bio-inspired algorithms for this, such as flocking and et cetera?
Well, you know, I use the concept. We in this case, you know, we get a lot of inspiration from nature and so on. In this case, we haven't used much of that. In this case, really was more like an idea of pixels flying. You know, how we can do the helicopter smaller and then keep them in the air and do this. But so I would say it's a very important source of inspiration for us. It wasn't that much in this project.
Mm-hmm. Okay. So maybe to touch on a slightly other topic here. So Flyfire is conceived as a public space installation, right? So it's ultimately going to be happening where you have people moving around, doing things. And I was wondering if you have to, before you actually try this out in spaces where you do have people moving around, do you have to consider security issues, or how do you guarantee that your pixels won't just, you know, drop down from space? And what happens if they do? How does one have to go about actually installing
well,
such
well, you
a
know,
thing?
It's funny that you mentioned it, because a few months ago we presented it at TED in California, and you know, there everybody was concerned. I flew one of the pixels up in the air, and you know, Bill Gates and a few other people were there in the audience, and we were concerned that this would fall on his head mm-hmm. or something. But you know, in the end, these are fixes. They're very, very light, so it's even if it falls on you, it's not really a big deal. It's a few grams rotating in the air, so it's not going to harm you.
Okay, so I did actually love your launch video of Flyfire. What is the status of the project today?
Well, we've been able to fly a number of them, and then at the moment, actually, we're working on two sides. We've been trying to solve the interference problems we have when you scale up, and we're also trying to solve the locationing problem, because, as I said at the beginning, we've been using cameras, and it's fine to go to use cameras up to 50. But then if you really want to think about a larger number, you need to have an internal indoor locationing system with good accuracy, and the board that's very, very light. And that we haven't solved yet. We got a few good ideas, but we're still working on it.
Okay. Do you have an ultimate kind of maximum number of pixels that you want to build?
Well, we think that the effect you have is the effect you have when the lights are off and so on is quite striking, because especially when you turn a pixel off, it disappears, and then it appears in another position. So you can still, even with a small number, you can still create very, very exciting effects. Now, we believe that beyond 100, it gets super interesting.
Okay. So I'll be looking forward to the advances in that project. Let me touch on another project that you actually have been doing in your lab. The project is called Sea Swarm, a fleet of low-cost, oil-absorbing robots. So maybe you want to start off by introducing this project and the motivation a little bit?
Sure, absolutely. Well, you know, this is something that was actually commissioned to us as a project. You know, not the full project, but as an idea. It was commissioned to us by the Venice Biennale last year, and you know, this was after the big accident in the Gulf of Mexico with the oil spill, and you know, BP and the big oil spill. And so people were trying to many different ways to collect oil from the water. And most of the approaches were actually based on very big vehicles actually going through the water and, you know, collecting the oil. But if you think about it, that becomes, you know, very difficult because it's a system that doesn't scale up. And so again here we thought, well, can we think about something very small, a small vehicle that actually could collect oil from the water, could use the oil to power itself, or use, well, part of the oil to power itself, or it can be either that or use just solar energy. But then you got a swarm of them, and they just move very, very slowly. And you know, and then you can scale it up and really have many and do much more work than what you would do with just one big vessel. So that was the initial idea. So the Venice Biennale didn't ask us about, you know, about this in particular, but, you know, they wanted us to do something related to the oil spill. And I think most people were looking at big kind of interventions, and we say, well, can we do something very small and just have many of them? Probably it scales up better.
Right, and so you actually intuitively went for a swarm approach again, like for the Pixels project?
Yes.
Okay, so there again, did you favor a centralized or rather distributed architecture for your system?
Well, you know, in this case, you don't have the weight problems you have with fly fire, so you can really put much more intelligence on every unit. Let me tell you first about the two things that allowed us to develop it. The first one is a new type of membrane. It's a nanomembrane that absorbs oil from the water, sucks it from the water. And so it's a new type of material actually developed at MIT by someone who actually now is at EPFL, Francesco Stellacci, who moved as a professor just after the project to EPFL. And so the first thing is this. And then the other thing that was quite interesting was, you know, if you think about ships, people always have been thinking about moving something quite heavy and quite fast in the water. Now, in our case, we wanted to move something even slowly. You know, speed was not an issue, and something quite light, like a piece of cloth on the water. And in doing that, actually, we came up with an idea that turned out to be quite interesting, which is, you know, you can have almost like a tapis roulant on the water, something that rotates very, very slowly onto the water and collects, absorbs the oil, and then extracts it. So the way of moving is not the shape and so on is not traditional shape. It's almost like, yes, a tapis roulant that's rotating on the water and slowly moving on the top of it.
Mm-hmm. Do your agents actually communicate with each other? I know that they communicate to a centralized kind of unit, but do you have any auto organization going on?
Yes, absolutely. They talk to each other as well.
Okay, and so I also know that you're using some sophisticated algorithms to detect the regions of interest, which in this case would be the oily regions. Could you comment on your coverage strategies?
Yes. Again, you know, we developed a few prototypes for this, but the main idea is that because each of them talks to all the others, then you got a sensing system on board as well. So So actually you can get that information to better understand where to go with these robots. And this information coupled with the centralized system information is what allows you to actually tackle the oil on the water.
Right. Mm-hmm. Okay. So you actually mentioned before that you're solving the autonomy issues very elegantly by employing photovoltaic cells on top of the robot. Can you give us an idea of how efficient this is in terms of time, for instance?
Sure, absolutely. Well, you know, our initial idea was, can we get the oil and then and then burn the oil and use the oil as a way to propel the thing? Now, that was our initial idea, but then we run into two troubles with that. The first one is, of course, that then when the whole ocean is clean, all of the robots will die because, you know, there's no oil anymore that they can collect. And the second problem is that if you do it that way, you also, you know, oil is unrefined oil, and so it's not easy to burn it and to get energy out of it. So it gets very quickly quite heavy and quite clunky. So in the end, yes, the final prototype is with photovoltaics, and because of this way to move it, so the power you need is very, very little. As you see, you know, it's almost like a cloth that's moving on the surface of the water. So it's very, very light, and it's moving like a cloth that's rotating on the surface of the water. And so because of that, with just the photovoltaics on the top surface, we can run it indefinitely because, you know, all the energy, we collect more energy than what we need.
Okay. So what is actually the status of this project today?
Well, you know, we've done the prototypes, and MIT decided to file a patent, and so there's some interesting developments from this point of view. Now, we also realized that we did it as a replying to this invitation by the Venice Biennale, but it's not really on the core of our lab really looks at more at the urban environment or our living environment, the interface between us and that. So these two things combined with the fact that also there was, at least the big spill from 2 years ago is now over. So we haven't developed it further much, but we got a lot of interest from different partners who want to take it and develop it further. And so it's one of those MIT patents and projects that I guess will, through one way or another way, we'll get into product stage quite soon.
Okay. So yes, indeed, actually, you did move away from your core, which would be cities, to actually the ocean on this project.
Yes, but you know, it's something everybody needs to do when there's an emergency, and you know, especially in this case, we had a clear request, and so we tried to do it. We tried to help how we could, whichever way we could, and I believe, you know, many people got inspired and we believe there's interesting developments, but then in a certain sense we decided, you know, we didn't really want to create a team of 5 people working full time on this in the lab because it was going to be too far from our core.
Right. So do you think that if one day this whole project would be commercialized, that do you really see this being employed for any future oil spills if that should happen?
Well, you know, there's a lot of investment, really. And, you know, let me say, in a case like in the Gulf of Mexico, it's going to be difficult after the spill to collect all of that water. But you've got plenty of cases like in the delta of the Niger, Niger River, and in other places where you've got small oil spills. And a lot of these spills are actually next to the coast and so on. And so this becomes a very inexpensive way to have a swarm of them next to each platform, really collecting the little spills that happen all the time when you got a platform in the ocean. So that's also the feedback we got from many petrochemical companies who are interested in developing it further, that, you know, it's really the interest is for small cleaning around places where, you know, the small spills happen all the time.
Right, so more like a kind of an assistive kind of system.
Correct, and then when you do that, you know, if you have this, you know, the cost of them is going to be very, very cheap, so you can have a swarm of 10 or 100 next to the platform, and, you know, that's a very little cost, and it helps you to keep the environment cleaner.
Okay, very nice. So I have a couple of more kind of general questions. So the projects undertaken in your lab take pervasive computing to a whole new level. And I do think that soon pervasive computing will be a household term. Where do you see this going?
Well, it's interesting that you mentioned it. You know, pervasive. Yes, it is about pervasive computing. It's about this idea that it will be computing everywhere. Now, the beautiful thing is that when computing is everywhere, you can finally forget about it, and then we can go back really to the things we care about, which is the interaction with our environment. So, in a certain sense, what I find fascinating about this is that yes, it is about computing and how computing is becoming pervasive, ubiquitous, and it's everywhere. But in the end, this goes back to two things, to us and the environment, to humans, so the human dimension, and the way we as humans interface with our cities, our buildings, and, you know, all of what is around ourselves.
Right. So you do mention something which I actually like very much. You say that you're bringing computing to such a level that you're actually forgetting about it again, that it's so seamlessly integrated with whatever we're doing that it's not actually there anymore. And somehow the projects that you're working on are constantly emphasizing this seamless kind of link between art, architecture, design, technology. And this also results in the fact that you have visibility and recognition in both the art and in the tech world. So is this actually a conscious priority for you, or is this just how the projects end up evolving?
Well, thank you for this question. I was never asked this question. I'm not really sure if it is conscious or not. Yes, you're absolutely right, because we think that the most successful projects, for instance, are projects like the one we did last summer that was both exhibited at MoMA, so at the Museum of Modern Art, because of the vision of tracking objects, tracking trash, and so on. And at the same time, also got published in very good scientific journals because they provided new glimpses into, say, computing or waste management, or in this case, waste management or other things. And in a certain sense, you know, I don't know if it is conscious or unconscious, but I believe that the key advances in research in the past always came from a vision. Sometimes because we had to do something, it was the vision about putting a man on the moon, and then because of that we had to solve a number of issues, and then we opened completely new fields because of that. Digital image processing and so on were developed because of the mission to the moon 40 years ago. Well, in a similar way, I believe that it is very useful in the research we do to try to create our own moon, to create our own vision, and you know, and the vision is what then will go in the domain of art, will go to the Museum of Modern Art in New York or to other similar places, and then at the same time develop the science in order to achieve that vision. And if you do that, I believe not only, you know, there will be the vision which is then will inspire others and so on, but also you will probably make more advances in science because you jump to it. You don't really do it the way I've done it in my PhD and the way it is normally done, which is by incremental little steps, but you try to look at the vision and let it inspire also from the scientific point of view. So in a certain sense, we enjoy that much, which is doing research through jumps.
Right. So your lab has a lot of experience in implementing very avant-garde projects, many of which are related to robotics. So what kind of progress would you like to see coming from the robotics research in order to support your work, and vice versa? What do you think that your research brings the robotics community?
Well, you know, I think the best contact point is really the fact that I believe that the great advance with robots will happen when we will not recognize them as robots anymore. I think in a lot of research, there's still the idea that robots should look like a robot. But I think the best robots are the ones that do not look like robots, that become seamlessly integrated with us and with the environment. And I think that's also where there could be, there could be great collaborations. There is great collaboration between us and people doing more robotics. We do a little bit of it, but mostly we interface with other groups at MIT and elsewhere on it, because then it's really about thinking about, again, about people and the environment. And robots are part of that equation.
Excellent. So thank you very much for joining us on Robots, Carlo.
Thank you very much for having me.
And that's all for today. As always, you can find more information and great videos linked to today's episode on our website at robotspodcast.com. Our next episode is due in 2 weeks' time. Until then, goodbye. Sensible Cities with Robots, the podcast for news and views on robotics.